I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors from the University of Texas Health Science Center, and I have no relationships to disclose. And I'm going to be talking about preventable medical errors that include injuries, at least in the biggest sense. And if you thought of those as injuries, they'd be the eighth most common cause of injury in the United States. And in our study, we focused more on errors resulting from adverse drug events. They're common, they can kill you, they can injure you. They're in all kinds of hospitals, big and small, high performers, low performers, and they're costly, both to the healthcare organization and to individuals. And they're especially dangerous in ICUs or in intensive care units, where there are vulnerable patients. Some of them are unconscious. There's a lot of use of IV medications, high hazard medications, and indeed the rate of adverse drug events in ICUs is twice as much as in non-intensive care units. So in response to this, I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, are familiar with the IOM report to Err is Human. And one of their key principles was to create a learning environment, to implement mechanisms of feedback and learning from error. And as an organizational sociologist, this is an area that is of special interest to me. And one of the areas where creating a learning environment is especially important is for residents or trainees. I'm going to use residents as a shorthand for everyone from first-year interns to four-year residents. Because residents are expected to make mistakes. They're learning. And indeed, if you, one of my colleagues, Hardeep Singh, looked at some of the malpractice cases where trainee errors were involved and found many of them were attributed to lack of supervision. And as many of you may know, residents are supervised through the traditional medical hierarchy. The attendings are over the fellows, who indeed are over the residents. And if the residents have questions, they go up the chain of command. And there's, interestingly, even though this form of supervision has been around for probably ages, it's part of the medical tradition, there's very little known about processes of supervision. And in a recent IOM report in 2008, they called for more supervision research. And in fact, the traditional way of looking at supervision is to see it in terms of the position and to look at the supervising physicians who are monitoring what the residents do. The 2000 IOM report changed focus a bit and looked at the content and said, building on a definition by Kilminster and Jolly, it's providing trainees with monitoring guidance and feedback as they care for patients. Well, we built on that definition, and we are conceptualizing supervision as a process. Now, when you think of supervision as a process, and then you ask the residents who monitored, guided, and gave you feedback as you cared for patients, and in our particular study, we focused on medication-related issues, not only did they mention getting feedback by their attendings and their fellows and their upper year residents, but also from nurses, clinical pharmacists, and staff pharmacists. And so this is a qualitative research study, and from this broader research project, three research questions emerged. How do residents experience feedback from other professionals? Other professionals is our shorthand for nurses, pharmacists, and clinical pharmacists. And how do other professionals provide feedback to residents? And finally, how do organizational conditions influence the interprofessional supervision of residents? By interprofessional, we mean the pharmacists, clinical pharmacists, and staff pharmacists that provide supervision from residents. And now you know what we came up with shorthands. This is a qualitative study. It emerged from a larger research project. In fact, one that Eric Thomas and I worked on, How Do Hospitals Learn from Medication Errors? And I'd like to acknowledge our funding from ARC. The goal of this study is to build conceptual frameworks to guide future research and to raise questions that might offer some practical suggestions. We looked at ICUs in three tertiary care hospitals, and we did what's called a purposeful random sampling of 17 residents. Now, all of you, I'm sure, are aware of the purpose of random sampling in quantitative research has a different use in qualitative. This is not a representative sample, but rather our goal was try to reduce bias. But we were wary of, we didn't want the supervisor to pick the three best residents. So we did it as randomly as possible. We conducted very extensive interviews. Each interview was at average 30 pages. Of the 30 pages, about two-thirds of them, the residents talked about their training experience. We supplemented the interviews by observing routine activities and also gathering documents. Just a quick overview of the data analysis. We had a coding team. We came in clean. No a priori categories, although as we coded, we were informed by organizational theory and research. We also had a team of devil's advocates. They were the MDs on our team who tried to poke holes in our theme, so we are in an attempt to validate the data. I'm going to talk about the results and kind of group them by the three research questions. So we'll talk first about how the residents experienced feedback, how the professionals provided the feedback, and finally we'll look at organizational conditions. So when we look at how residents experienced feedback, it turned out that they were not only receiving feedback from these pharmacists and nurses, but they were also initiating supervision or asking questions. Let's focus first on receiving feedback. One of the interesting things that came up is that they perceived the other professionals to be non-judgmental. And there was a clear pattern of deferential language. And I'll show you some examples in a minute. And because the other professionals were not in positions of authority, they had no ranking in the traditional medical hierarchy, they had no authority to evaluate the residents. And that was a positive thing from the point of view of the residents. But there was some ambiguity about how do they receive feedback from non-physicians. And I realize that's a little ambiguous, and you'll see in a minute. Let me illustrate it with some quotes. Again, we have quotes for everything. And in qualitative research, the hardest thing about a presentation is to cut out the quotes. So these are here to kind of give you a flavor for the research. Example of deferential language, across all three hospitals, different time periods. The pharmacy called me up and said, now listen, are you sure you want to give that dosage? The nurse might say, oh, you really? You sure you want to give this? And here's a wonderful quote, which I thought both illustrated the ambiguities of getting feedback from someone who's not above you in the chain of command, but yet the benefits of not having someone being evaluating you and teaching you at the same time. I don't know if some people might psychologically think it was better or worse. Worse because it was coming from a nurse and maybe somebody would think that they wouldn't know as much. Maybe it's better because that way, like maybe the fellow or attending wouldn't find out that you made a mistake. So there's some benefits from receiving feedback from a nurse. Okay, now if we look at the other point of view, how do residents describe how they initiated supervision or asked for advice? Well, they found other professionals to be both approachable and available. Common sense, they were there, who was there on nights and weekends? And often, in some of the cases, the staff, in one of the hospitals, the staff pharmacist actually worked on the unit. They had their workstation there. They weren't just assigned to the unit, but that was their home. So here's a typical quote. You can just take the clinical pharmacist to the side and say, hey, listen, I forgot this medication. What am I supposed to give? It starts with an L. So that kind of summarizes a little bit of the giving and taking of, do I have 5 minutes left? Is it? Oh, okay. Second research question, how do the other professionals provide feedback? I'm going to touch briefly on the methods they used and their sources of expertise. These should look familiar with anyone who's worked in a hospital. It happens at the ordering stage, where nurses and pharmacists double-check the residents' medication orders. It happens during implementation, that where before you give a medication, at least in the ideal world, you double-check the physician's order. And let me give you a quote to illustrate what guiding future directions is, because that's less intuitive. And we had a wonderful quote from one of the residents. The nurses talk to you about everything. They see the labs before you. They see the labs in the morning and are like, his potassium is high. Can you fix this? His blood pressure has been running up. Do you want to give him something? They guide you towards making the right decision. So they're not only following up and monitoring, but they're also guiding, supervising. So in the medical chain of command, it's clear why the attendings and the fellows have authority to be they're supervising physicians. But we were puzzled, what is the source of authority for non-physicians? Well, for pharmacists, it was standards. You know, part of this is actually embedded in their software and in their computer. They have a standard range of doses, so they compare the residents to a normal dosage range, for example. For clinical pharmacists, in addition to the standard range of dosage and the standards, they're also comparing the residents' decisions to the latest research. And with nurses, it's experience-based. They're comparing the residents' decisions to what the usual practice is on the unit. And let me illustrate that briefly. The nurses can pick up mistakes just as easily as anyone else because they're used to this environment, and they're used to seeing all the orders that are written generally. So they can, if they look at a resident's order, they can say, this is exceptional, this is unusual, and ask about it. Okay. The third research question focuses on organizational conditions. The first one's pretty straightforward, access. It goes back to ancient classic work in sociology, proximity. If you work or live near someone, you're more likely to interact with them. Organizational culture is a little bit more subtle. So access can be as simple as the staff pharmacist working in the ICU, as I mentioned earlier, but we were struck by one of our findings, that in South and North hospitals, almost all the residents mentioned interactions with the clinical pharmacist. But in West Hospital, we didn't have one mention, which is unusual. I mean, to see such a clear pattern. And when we looked into it, we said there are clinical pharmacists in all three hospitals. It turns out that in West Hospital, there was a clinical pharmacist who only intermittently rounded with the different units because they didn't have enough clinical pharmacists. And so this lack of proximity made a big difference in how the residents perceived them and how they interacted with them. So even though proximity is kind of common sense, it can be really important and easy to change. Organizational culture is tougher to change. Some of the cultural elements we saw were part of what it means to be in an ICU. The residents mentioned that ICU nurses and pharmacists were brave enough to ask questions or they weren't intimidated. I want to focus here on how the attendings set norms. And again, to change this doesn't cost. Wonderful quote from one of the residents, Dr. X, tells the residents first, flat out, orientation, first day, listen to the nurses. If you get in an argument with a nurse, 95% of the time I'm on his side. So immediately setting the norms that the nurses are, you can ask the nurses for advice and you should listen to them when they offer direction. Limitations to our study. It was specific to medications and to the ICU. It was part of a larger research project. We didn't start off looking specifically at supervision, although it was focused on learning. But despite that, we had abundant data. Fully two-thirds of the transcripts talked about these training and learning issues. We had a small sample, but on the other hand, it was incredibly rich data. We had wonderful, abundant, and vivid examples. Just briefly, I want to highlight some of the conceptual frameworks. First of all, in addition to having supervision as a process, we saw it as a two-way process in which the residents both received and initiated and asked for feedback. We don't propose that this exists in a void, but rather it complements the traditional way of looking at supervision. So when you're talking about the learning environment for residents, it's not enough to look just up and down in the traditional chain of command, but also to look at the interprofessional exchange of feedback. Now, in terms of the conceptual framework and theoretical terms, we highlighted three sets of variables. One is communication. Here we're focusing on interpersonal communication. And cockpit resource management or crew resource management talked about the difficulties in the traditional physician chain of command, why it's sometimes, how do you question what your attending is doing? But here we have a condition not of clear status differences, but ambiguous status differences. So it suggests an area for future research. Also, to look at the proximity to other professionals, which can be shaped easily by work routines, and also looking at the norms of organizational culture, both what are the norms on the unit level, similar to the work that Amy Edmondson did for nurses, where she looked at norms of psychological safety in various units. And finally, some suggestions for improving the learning environment and through that improving patient safety really focus on the organizational conditions. This can be done training healthcare providers both in communication skills and in teamwork skills such as mutual performance monitoring. So there's a whole other perspective of this. So not only are the clinical pharmacists, and nurses monitoring the physicians, but the residents are supposed to also be monitoring the other professionals, and we have some more data on that. But both of these skills, we know how to do this, and they're trainable. We also know how to design jobs and work routines. How can we make simple changes? And it could be just simply taking the computer of the staff pharmacist and putting it in the ICU, which is relatively costless. We know how to do it. And finally, setting norms. It's hard to change organizational cultures, but these attendings managed in the first few days of a rotation to set the norms of that rotation. I am wrapping up. This is my last slide. And so to end, really, after we've heard these really saddening statistics on the rate of preventable patient injuries, either by falling, by mouth, or by foot, you know, you can get hurt anyway. On one hand, the traditional medical hierarchy is firmly rooted in organizational professional cultures. It's changing gradually. There's been a beginning of emphasis on teams, but any organizational culture moves slowly. I want to end on a note of optimism and say that organizational conditions can be changed. They're very low cost, and what at least our exploratory research suggests, they can have a big impact on the learning environment of residents.
So, you had your hand up first.
I am
going to
ask a question, but given your closing comments, I feel the impulse to make a comment.
Please, go ahead.
Talking about quality improvements, just evolving to the new. I can remember in the mid-70s writing impassioned memoranda to my boss, who was director of the Department of Improvement and Medicaid, writing that because professional standards review organizations were reviewing what was going on, and my question was, why should Medicaid be paying for care that is required due to iatrogenic injury?
Yeah, I believe we actually have several people who can address that.
I'm not asking you to address, I'm responding to your point.
There's a decade coming, yes.
And that it's not very old. Bring forth a point of view that I agree with you, and I find it morally offensive that that is true. I asked a physician who headed a PSRO in Detroit, again, this is the mid-70s, what do you do when you find evidence of malpractice? And I really hit home, and he looked at me with just such openness and said, I wish you would tell me what I could find. But that was just a comment.
No, thank you. Thank you for the comment.
I have a question to ask. It is my observation based on experience that many physicians, especially specialists, maybe even all physicians, at some point are themselves have limited English proficiency. And their limited English proficiency is acquired. And it is acquired in the course of training. I would like to continue. I understand your urge to interrupt, but I can do better if I get to get to the period, if you don't mind. It is acquired, and patients, there are moments when I'm willing to say that patients are sheep. I know that isn't very flattering, but at least they're not willing to challenge. In my own experience as a breast cancer patient, dealing with different kinds of specialists and their residents and people in training, I got the term, I even got an appointment with a surgeon where I didn't have to pay to go back to her office. I said, I want to talk with you about this. It happened, and I don't want to have to pay, and I got it. And one of the points I made to her was, you speak medical arcane. Now, I have 3 degrees, so I feel I'm just as trained as and as intelligent as the healthcare person speaking to me. I'm just not trained in the same field, and I wonder what's happening to the person who hasn't even graduated from high school. So it really infuriates me, and I am planning to submit an article to Narrative Matters and Health Affairs, if you're familiar with that. But I have a question. There are 2 questions I want to ask you about the language. It occurs to me that it's possible that when you're using interpreters, that the problem is solved, and that the arcane terminology isn't transferred into the other language, but that the interpreter actually says what it actually means so that the patient understands it, which would be a marvel, and it would be great if it could be transferred back to the English-speaking world. Secondly, I will submit to you this, and at least in Michigan, I'm a member of the State Bar of Michigan, and we have every month in the Bar Journal a column called Plain English, because it is at least recommended to lawyers. Who knows whether they have any capacity to pay attention, but it is recommended to them to use plain English. And I'm wondering if you all, in your research and your many team discussions, have thought about doing something to test whether plain English is being used and to train in plain English, and to have a standard of care that says, whatever you're doing,
pay your addresses. I am going to use my moderator prerogative because we have other people who have questions. I saw hands come up. So would you like to come up and address that?
Thank you for raising that. I confess that it isn't something that we have actually thought about directly. We've been very focused on individuals who do not speak English proficiently, and thinking about providers who don't speak the patient's language proficiently. But in terms of being able to, an interpreter being able to actually not only interpret the language, but also medicalese, that's an interesting sort of point to sort of cover. I really can't say that we've actually addressed the issues around using acronyms and using jargon. But Rob, if you have any points.
I think it's important to consider what modality of interpreting you're using, because in black box interpreting, you would still get the same arcane language. They would just translate it word for word. If you have someone who is doing sort of more cultural brokering, then they might say, they might explain it to the patient and translate it back, and it's sort of a mixed modality. Someone might take the time out and say, doctor, could you please give me the English for that so I can tell them? So it really depends on the training of the interpreter and the modality of the work. Mm-hmm.
And I'll add to that, just in terms of the training piece with interpreters, it's it's one thing to memorize medical terminology, but I think the other piece that gets built into sort of training programs is actually knowing what that term really means so that you can explain it in a different way. And so we do require that all our interpreters are trained in that particular way.
And that's why you want to use dedicated medical interpreters. Handling the interpreter is not enough, but a certified medical interpreter would understand the terminology in a way that they could.
So.
Right, Grant?
Sure, yes. So for Dr. Tammuz, thank you for breaking into the black box of this experience that all physicians, nurses, and pharmacists have had. I would be very interested to see if you could break down your data a little bit more granularly to, you know, the first year resident versus, you wrote fourth, but you have a seventh year resident in surgery. And the difference between how that first year intern receives information from the 30 year ICU nurse versus the first year floor nurse and the seventh year surgery resident experiencing the same is very different, I would say. And I also think, this is sort of my own observation experience, pharmacists tend to interact with residents sort of a more objective way. Is that dose really what you want, and so forth? But the nurses, there's a different cultural issue going on. And so while on the page you can say, do you really want to give that dose? Sometimes it's more frequently, do you really want to give that dose, parentheses, idiot? and I don't think, I mean, I see it there and it's possible, but it's certainly taken sometimes less as a helpful comment, and sometimes it's given less as a helpful comment, but you lose the nuance in the printed page.
No, actually, we have those exceptions.
Okay, good.
They just wasn't enough. Thanks. I'm glad you asked the question, because I wanted to, that's what hit the cutting floor. Interesting idea about looking at it more year by year. Because this was not designed originally to look at these issues, I think, you know, when we do a continuation of the study, we'll really look at variations of experience, because it turned out to be very relevant, for the nurses. And it's an interesting question, can an intern recognize the difference between a baby nurse and an experienced nurse? And so that would really be a really great
idea. Nurse can certainly recognize.
Oh yeah.
Intern.
Oh yeah, the nurse certainly knows the difference. And we also had people who talked about exceptions. What happened when the nurse mocked him when he asked a question? So we did have those extremes. And part of this is what, when I was talking about the ambiguity of the relationship, because the nurses, in order to establish their authority, they sometimes belittle the residents. So that's why this issue of how to communicate, you don't need to use deferential language, but can you use non-judgmental language? And what we were thinking about is training not just for the residents, but training for everyone. And as actually part of the study, we asked people, were you ever trained in communicating about errors? And no one had been. So thank you very much for the suggestion.
We have a couple minutes.
Question?
Hi, Megan from Southeastern Michigan, the Detroit area. And I am a member of the Diversity RX class, CLAS, talk listserv by email. And hot conversation right now is about waivers for interpreter services. So I'm just curious, in the EMR that you're working on, if that is documented in there when someone is waiving interpreter services.
So that is a very contentious issue. And we had, during our initial sort of piloting phase, developed a waiver and actually had it translated in all our main languages and was having that reviewed by our legal department. I had mentioned that we had a clinical, the nursing informatics, director of nursing informatics, who was a great champion in this, and she said, if you want to do this documentation, you have to kill the waiver. That's not going to happen. So unfortunately, at this time, we have something ready to go that we could use, but at this point, we don't have a way to have the waiver available. I mean, we do have an staff intranet where we could post it, and it would be something where we'd have to develop a process where the waiver would get signed and then get it scanned into the EMR. But that's something that, that's a battle that we've sort of reserved for later.
It was so onerous a process. We had paper versions after the commission to get them signed. It just wasn't going to get done. So I think we opted in part of the choice elections to the drop down list. You could say patient preferred this as sort of a happy meeting, but it's just so onerous to do it. We just realized.
Thank you very much. I want to thank all of our panelists. Great job.
Thank you.